Tyler.
Yeah?
Which member of Public Enemy do you prefer?
Well, I watched a lot of Flavor Flav's show back in the day, The Flavor of Love, so I'm going to go with Flavor Flav.
This motherfucker thought we were doing a podcast on the rap group Public Enemy. This is why I told you we need to clarify this. He didn't watch wrestling till 2003. He doesn't even know what theme song Public Enemy came out to. And that's like half of Public Enemy. Okay? Like, I can't. I told you you need to have better outlines. You just can't say, hey, let's research Public Enemy. This guy is going to talk about the He Got Game soundtrack probably in about an hour and a half. He's going to talk about Do the Right Thing in about 20 minutes. Not about the ECW arena, WCW. He has no idea who we're talking about today. So how about we just stop the recording right now? Let's stop it. Let's let Tyler do a little bit of research.
And we're back. All right, Jake, I took the 20 minutes. Here's what I have for you. Nah, 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 nah. Na 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 na.
That's a good start.
All right. Okay. That's a good start. That's right, good start. Good. Like I said, he's got at least half of Public Enemy right now. He's got that. So, all right, let's continue on with the episode.
All right. Welcome to take two of Ten Bell Pod. I'm Nick Alexander, joined by research master Tyler Wood.
Hey, let's rock and roll here.
We are joined by the tent murderer, the man scout Jake Maddie.
The camp hot stepper, if you will.
Ah, there you go. God, how did I miss that?
Huh. How did you miss that? Camp fire hot stepper. What around.
All right. Today, we are discussing one of the biggest tag teams of the 90s, a cornerstone of ECW, the Public Enemy. I know we kind of talked about this in our secret message group. I thought this was going to be the easiest cover. Like, I would just watch a couple of the very many available shoot interviews because, obviously, the entire shoot interview industry would want to speak to Public Enemy, a paramount cog of ECW, or at the very least, guys who were in the ECW locker room for so long that they probably saw some fucked up shit. But no, not a single one, shame on you, Hannibal, RF, High Spots, and possibly Jake Maddie.
Like I said, there was a interview shoot style done, and it's sprinkled throughout. Gosh, what's it called? It's one of the ECW documentaries. Like it's like Barbed Wire City. You'll see clips of it with like Rocco Rock, maybe a few Johnny Grunge, but it's mostly Rocco Rock. And actually, High Spots bought the rights to that footage. Never secured the actual footage, but most certainly sent the payment over. And then the guy who owns the footage died. And they're like, oh, well, Jake knows where this footage is somewhere in High Spots. So they send me a message, I don't know, 2 years after I said, fuck you guys, I quit, asking me where this Public Enemy footage is, to which I said, you've always thought you had it. I've always told you we haven't had it. And for you to send payment without getting the footage promptly thereafter is bad business, which you've done multiple times before, and then look at me to come up with some sort of solution. And I'm telling you, there is no solution because you never got the footage, and I've told you twice that you don't have the footage. Now this guy is dead, and nobody has the footage. And you have now gone out and recorded interviews to do a Public Enemy documentary, thinking you had interview footage of at least one member of Public Enemy, to which you don't. So just missed out on the whole shooter interview craze. You know, Johnny Grunge was around for a little bit. I'm surprised he didn't do one. Seems like he would have been around. But he just, I think Johnny might have been in the Midwest out there for a while, not in a good place even to just talk in front of a camera in a Super 8 motel for Rob Feinstein. Like, bad. But yeah, very surprising that we never had a shoot interview, because I mean they were recording them in 97, 98, 2000s, 2003s, and with Rocco's passing in 2002, just missed it.
Jake, I have a question. How do you gauge what, I assume this is fan cam footage, how do you gauge its worth if you're High Spots or Smart Mark Video or one of the other few places that would actually be in the market to buy it?
Well, let me tell you what WWE does. They offer you $1 million. You give them all their footage. WWE says, all of this footage is substandard and the quality's poor. We don't want any of it. So the $1 million offer is off the table. But we'll offer you $10,000. And they have all the footage in their hand. Basically, it's kind of like, hey, we've got all the tapes right now. We'll give you $10,000 for it. And then somebody that did all this work for it was expecting $1 million. Can't really negotiate it because it's WWE. So you're just being bent over a barrel and you're like, all right, just send the $10,000. And then they got the rights to it. So that's usually how it works.
Bullshit. All right. Well, that said, obviously, once you start getting away from their actual documented wrestling career, there is surprisingly not that much out there about Public Enemy. But let's kick things off with Ted Petty. Theodore James Petty, a.k.a. Rocco Rock, was born September 1st, 1953 in Woodbridge Township, New Jersey. He graduated from Rutgers University with a degree in nutrition before hopping into a brief boxing career. In the late 70s, he started getting trained by Afa of the Wild Samoans and debuted in 78 as the Cheetah Kid.
Go watch some Cheetah Kid matches, folks. Yeah. Holy shit, is it good. To see an American do some of those high-flying maneuvers in the 70s will blow your mind. I mean, you would expect something in like the late 90s, like Hardy Boys era, where like they were watching New Japan Juniors tapes and just emulating it. Rocco Rock was doing some shit in the late 70s that was rival to like a Black Tiger. Nobody was as good as Tiger Mask, but I mean, Cheetah Kid could have rolled and had good matches with the Dynamite Kid for sure. That's why Rocco was always kind of like the high flyer of the group. He was kind of fearless, even though the Rocco Rock gimmick came around because like he was a little older, had a few more injuries, but still had that fearlessness that you need as a high flyer. And also the boxing background. That's why always his punches look so good. And he always got in the ring and always kind of did the jabs to kind of warm himself up and get him in that mindset of having a match. So yeah, Cheetah Kid, holy shit. Go out of your way to find something with him, anything at all, and just jacked, great body, great look. If you would have got maybe a little better mask or something like that, because the mask looked very Northeast Indie-ish, to say the least. But, you know, if you would have had like a really high-end mask or spent some money with a New Japan like mask maker and spent a little bit more on the gear, who knows? Who knows? Or it just had it come up a few years later. I don't know. Cheetah Kid, one of those very fascinating things in professional wrestling.
He eventually ended up doing enhancement matches for AWA. It looks like around 85 to 88. He did a couple with Cactus Jack. In March of 1990, Petty headed over for a tour of New Japan. He teamed up with Pegasus Kid. He wrestled people like Liger and Punisher Dice Morgan, who is who, Tyler?
It's The Undertaker, right?
He faced Redacted and Taker and tagged up with Scott Hall. So Cheetah Kid's like rubbing elbows with wrestling royalty over here in Japan. Back in America, he did some work for Tri-State Wrestling Alliance. June 9th, 1990, he beat Tom Pritchard for their version of the Brass Knuckles Championship. Seems like Tri-State is sort of the seeds for Eastern Championship Wrestling, which of course becomes Extreme Championship Wrestling before reaching its strongest and final form of the Pokemon evolution, WWECW.
Yeah. Exactly. Tri-State would always bring in Eddie Gilbert, and then kind of like that's how, you know, Eddie Gilbert was in Philly a lot. I think Tri-State was the place where they had the Three Stages of Hell match between Eddie Gilbert and Cactus Jack. And then that's also one where you brought in Kerry Von Erich for like the last time, where he was like in a mask and it was clearly Kerry Von Erich. They'd bring in Jerry the King Lawler from time to time. Yeah, it was like a really big indie when there weren't a lot of indies in existence whatsoever. And they were drawing good houses and putting on some really good shows. it just hadn't thought to record their shows and make them big into tape trading. It was kind of like, that's why some of those get lost to time. Every once in a while, you'll see one fan cam angle of a show or a match just knocking around. But it was definitely the thing that started ECW.
Adding to Ted's pretty awesome 1990 year, he got a handful of dates with WCW, including a fucking Starrcade. He worked a weekend as Cheetah Kid, beating Cactus Jack and Ray Apollo. He worked a weekend losing to Tim Horner as Mario Savoldi. Then he got into a tag team as the South African Colonel De Klerk, teaming up with Sergeant Kruger to defeat Beast and Kahlua at Clash of Champions 13 in November. Then came Starrcade 90. Colonel De Klerk and Sergeant Kruger was part of the Pat O'Connor Memorial International Cup Tag Team Tournament to determine Tag Team Champions of the Universe. Jesus Christ. JR says they are both former South African soldiers, so, you know, that would have been a good part of the shoot. But it is crazy to see Rocco, like, shirt off, jacked as hell, and just being a super serious wrestler.
Yeah, WCW this time was so fucking weird. I didn't grow up with it, but I really wish I could just go back and, like, watch it, because every once in a while I'm like, oh, there's a really great match right here, or, oh, that's a really popular territory guy just in here doing this weird-ass fucking gimmick and getting paid a lot of money by Ted Turner to have this match. And then, sure as shit, since he's a fucking territory guy, he's going to fuck this up by getting drunk or smarting off to Dusty or somebody. So he's going to be out of there. Just so fucking weird. But then there was like so many people that got opportunities during that time. And, you know, Rock was one of them.
The 8th seed South African team takes a pretty quick loss to the eventual tournament champions, spoiler, the Steiners, with Rocco doing the job to the Frankensteiner. In March of 91, Petty appeared with the UWF and Herb Abrams beating Beast on a Fury Hour taping, so he's part of that whole clusterfuck. And I would say in the Mortal Kombat opponent ladder, Tony Khan has officially defeated Herb Abrams. I would say Wembley was a fatality to Heyman. He's now fighting Ted Turner.
I never saw it that way, but I see Tony as his own special unicorn, to be really quite honest. We've never seen anything like him or like AEW. Like, you guys want to compare it to WCW as much as you want, and we have logos that are very similar to WCW, but what we are going through is a once in a lifetime, several lifetimes, of a very interesting wrestling experiment that has taken off. So, and that is why I'm keeping a journal. And at certain times, I feel like a war reporter, but history will be documented, and it will be documented by a man who's extremely fair. So, all my coworkers that do or do not listen to this podcast, be forewarned that I keep my ears open as I walk down the hallway. So, I know who's a dick and who's not. And history may remember you as such.
Jumping into June of 92, Petty was back over in Japan as Cheetah Kid for Wing and found himself in their junior heavyweight title tournament. Looks like he went up 3-3. From there, it was back to the American indie scene until early 93 when he wrestled Johnny Rotten, aka Johnny Grunge, for WWF. First at a house show and then a dark match, which I assume were tryouts, January 9th and 11th, after a tour of Austria and Germany, where they were again working opposite of each other, the two joined forces September 93 to form Public Enemy and ECW.
And from what I always heard about these two is that Ted was always like the guy who like worked out, he was dedicated, made sure everything was good to go on the level. Like, a very straightforward dude. And also, too, I think for a long time, he, like, rented rings out. Like, he had his own ring rental business as well, too. But I think even when he was wrestling as well, like, there's always thing of a Ted Petty ring in the Northeast, much in the same sense of a Ted Allen ring in the Southeast. Like, oh, I got a Ted Allen ring, or I'm renting Ted Allen in his ring. And, you know, Ted would show up at the ring and then obviously make money on the ring rental and then wrestle. I think Ted was kind of doing some of that as well, too. At this time as well, too, like, hey, you know, rent my ring and then you get the Cheetah Kid too, or you get Ted Petty or whatever I'm doing, to kind of double dip on it. Something that George South has done for decades, and that's the way he's been able to pay his bills through professional wrestling, is like, well, rent my ring, but if you rent my ring and rent me as a wrestler, it's this price. So Ted was always very straightforward, straight-laced, and to be a guy that, like, the whole show is depending upon you showing up with a wrestling ring shows you are a very responsible individual. Ted Petty's just a guy, a saint of a man.
All right, and that brings us to Michael Len Durham, a.k.a. Johnny Grunge, was born July 10th, 1966 in Sulphur, Louisiana. And yeah, it seems to be consensus that, like, everyone's like, oh yeah, I love Ted, and then I don't even really know Johnny. And that directly translates to the information available on these guys. Little bit on Ted Petty, nothing on fucking Mike. So we're going to jump right into him making his wrestling debut in 87. He quickly got himself into the WWF enhancement talent scene using his real name. You can see him on various WWF tapings, taking losses to Brutus Beefcake, Bat News Brown, Big Boss Man throughout 1990. Mike was also hitting the American Indies, working for International Championship Wrestling, a different one from the Poffos. The Machos hung out mostly in the South, and this one was Northeast. In 91, Michael also did some spots for UWF, including losing to Greg Valentine, Mike Sharp, Steve Williams under both his real name and as Equalizer Zap.
Opposite to Ted Petty as Cheetah Kid doing some revolutionary stuff and advanced stuff and really being ahead of his time, Johnny Grunge was doing just the very typical thing going on in every territory. I remember putting together a best of compilation of Public Enemy when we had licenses through our video to use the ECW video library. And Johnny Grunge had a Nature Boy robe on with blonde hair and doing every knockoff Ric Flair, Buddy Landell, Southern heel spot.
Adding to 1991, Mike did more jobs for WWF, losing to LOD, Ted DiBiase. He also faced Chris Candido some on the indie scene. He did some tagging with Tommy Rose for Wrestling Independent Network, and that takes us back to 1993 and fist fighting Cheetah Kid in WWF and abroad before heading to ECW September 93. So at this point, ECW was still Eastern Championship Wrestling, but not for too much longer, because that September, ECW had made another important hire for the company, a 28-year-old Paul Heyman. And it was Paul that gave Ted and Mike the gimmick of white guys who embraced hip-hop culture, giving them the name Public Enemy, which was already a rap group's name, formed in 85 with Chuck D and Flavor Flav, as Tyler knows. And if you know anything about the rap group Public Enemy and their message, a bunch of white dudes stealing their name, it is art imitating life, imitating art, imitating life.
At least they had cornrows. I feel like that was a good addition to the gimmick.
They eventually lost the black scent thing throughout. It would come in and out, and it was a lot better when they did.
I didn't hear any of those promos, Nick. What did they sound like?
I remember this being a thing, but I don't remember, like, if this was ever discussed, because obviously Ted had passed by the time that Jamie Dundee had been coming around high spots trying to pitch a shooter interview every month. But the idea of white dudes being rappers to get heat with wrestling, this was very, very much a new idea. The only person that would have done this prior to Public Enemy would have been Wolfie D. Wolfie D was doing that before he ever tagged up with Jamie Dundee, and he was JC Ice, and they were PG-13. And they also debuted in 1993 as well. So Paul Heyman, with his connections in Memphis and paying attention to stuff, he might have heard about Bill Dundee's kid doing this white rapper gimmick, and then, like, hey, I kind of want that here now that I'm booking here. That's getting a lot of heat in Memphis. Imagine how much heat that's going to get in Philadelphia. And I'm curious to explore that a little bit more, because who really did it first? Because from what it sounds, it probably Paul Heyman just ripped it off from Wolfie D, because he was basically John Cena in the early 90s before anybody else was doing anything of that sort. He did it so coolly, that people bought it and he didn't get heat, but he got like John Cena love right away. And that's kind of what PG-13 was doing in Memphis. So I wouldn't be surprised if Paul Heyman's like, I want my own PG-13 up here in Philadelphia.
The first person to get super over with a white guy rap gimmick would be Vanilla Ice in 1990.
That'll do it.
The Public Enemy, with Ted as Rocco Rock and Mike as Johnny Grunge, made their ECW debut September 18th, 1993 at ECW's Ultra Clash, opening up the show in a match against Ian Rotten and Jason Knight. And it is a weird reaction because I think they are the heels here. Then you have Rocco doing such cool shit. So they get this like mixed weird reaction, but they get a debut win.
And like ECW wasn't ECW yet. Like they hadn't figured out the aesthetic of it yet, and especially the aesthetic of the arena. I think it like Ultra Clash 3, like you can clearly see white walls in the background and everything's well lit. just so you could see the ring. Like they didn't have like spotlighting or light rigging above the ring, so you could just put light on the ring and then keep the rest of the arena dark. They just turned on all the lights so you can see how shitty it is everywhere, as opposed to creating some sort of aesthetic to the arena, because you watch some of those older tapes, it feels like there's 5,000 people there when really in actuality it's 1,800 people. But you have everybody in the camera shot reacting all together. That crowd was very much like a part of the show and part of the ambiance, as well as like it being very darkly lit, but then well lit around the ring. But yeah, the white walls in the background were very disconcerting. So like they're putting the pieces together for ECW this time, much like Public Enemy is putting the pieces together, you know, would become the team that basically built the ECW arena.
Yeah, they would slowly start chipping away, adding things, and taking steps to help usher in this new style of ECW hardcore, which revolutionized pro wrestling as they danced their way to the ring to Here Comes the Hot Stepper.
They also used to use Slam by Onyx, if I'm not mistaken. Slam! Da, 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 da,
they
da,
they feel
the
very
boys
similar.
Boys. Yeah, like they did that, but it was definitely a Hot Stepper. That was the one that really kicked it up a notch. And boy, like, you don't get those opportunities to really develop a character like that, especially in front of an audience and a TV camera. It happened very quick, but it had to happen very quick. You wouldn't have your time to do this over years. You really got to, you know, kick this into high gear and what this is going to be. And they did. Like, they really had a sense of what was going to work and kind of almost like, hey, this will really piss off the Philly crowd, when in actuality, they got in on the joke, which made it cooler, which then got it more over.
While the Dudleys seem to get a lot of credit for popularizing the tables match, it was in fact the Public Enemy that started using tables on a regular basis in ECW, although I believe Harley Race was the first wrestler to actually do table spots, and if he wasn't, he was, because he said he was, so he was.
Oh, Sabu will fight you on that goddamn nonsense. Sabu and Public Enemy used to get in like serious fucking fights over who was using the table. Sabu will claim that he was using the table like back when he was in Japan, like before he ever came to ECW, because basically his uncle would have him there as a child and be like, do something spectacular. And his idea was put a table in the ring and do a moonsault through it with nobody on top of it. And then Public Enemy like saw it and then started incorporating it in all their matches. But there was like a serious backstage brouhaha of who was using tables and what their thing, but I really think it was Sabu that was doing it before Public Enemy, and then Public Enemy kind of just took it and ran with it. So, and then obviously the Dudleys took it to another level as well too.
That's interesting. I've never had a time in wrestling where I've been watching and tables haven't been incorporated in one way or another. I guess I never gave it the thought of like, can you pinpoint that to the first time somebody used a table in pro wrestling? That's interesting.
Oh, I never thought that there was a whole, you know, wrestling history before 2003 when I was watching. La Resistance was my favorite old school tag team.
Freebird rule.
You don't even know what that means.
It's
like,
all three people can defend the tag titles. But
oh,
why?
So it's your, but why?
Because of the Freebirds.
Who were?
Michael P.S. Hayes and the other two. I don't.
Oh, fuck off.
Public Enemy started their run with a feud with Pat Tanaka and Paul Diamond of Bad Company, working house shows, NWA Bloodfest 93, and November to Remember, also hopping on their first ever Hardcore TVs. March 5th, 94, they beat the Bruise Brothers to become number one contenders for the tag titles. And the next night, they faced the 6-foot-tall combined tag team of Kevin Sullivan and the Tasmaniac for the ECW titles, which ended up landing on ECW Hardcore TV 47. Super weird ending to this match if you want to watch it, but despite getting hit with a hammer several times and Bruise Brothers interference, Public Enemy gets their first tag title win.
Man, Sullivan was like very adamant about hitting people with a fucking hammer. George South tells this story about Kevin Sullivan, WCW TV. He's like wanted to hit somebody with a hammer, and George's like, "Why? You're Kevin Sullivan. Why you gotta hit somebody with a hammer so many times?" And Kevin Sullivan is like, "I'm just trying to get over." But you're Kevin Sullivan. You're the devil. Why do you need to do all that? Just get over. But yeah, and I remember this kind of happening. I remember like people talk about Shane Douglas throwing down an NWA title being the thing that kind of changed what ECW was. But, you know, Taz is doing the Tasmaniac thing at this time, and Kevin Sullivan's still kind of doing what he did in Florida in the 80s a little bit. And them switching the tag belts over to Public Enemy, which is more of an updated 90s gimmick, like that. That really felt also like kind of like, ooh, this ECW thing is, it's going to be newer, hipper, cooler. Yeah. It was like a changing of the guard. You know, it's definitely like you at this point, you're seeing the less of the Don Morocco's and the Eddie Gilbert era of booking this ECW when it was Eastern Championship Wrestling. But yeah, like putting the belts on Public Enemy was like another little step of like, no. ECW is going to be this hip, cool 90s thing that's going to be happening.
PE spent the next couple of months holding off all challengers for their belts, including Bruise Brothers, Ian and Axel Rotten, and then they got into an absolutely fucking brutal feud with the Funk Brothers that leads to some pretty unforgettable ECW spots.
These old men were trying to kill themselves.
They were just Terry. I was like, okay, I associate this with Terry. But seeing Dory Funk do this shit, I was like, dude, you were like NWA champion in like seven. I mean, so was Terry, but I was concerned for his well-being.
Dude, when in the barbed wire match, when Dory like tripped over something and fell, I'm like, Jesus Christ, because I panicked because I saw an old person fall.
You also got to remember when these two brothers were fighting in Japan, they were fighting against the Sheik and Abdul the Butcher. So, like, we always want to associate Terry with doing the hardcore wrestling, and Dory was a serious wrestler. Dory was out there doing some of the crazy shit with Terry. Terry did it for a few years longer. Yeah. So,
at 94's Heat Wave, Public Enemy beat the Funks in a barbed wire match as the Philly crowd chanted, "We want blood, we want blood," which is a traditional Philly chant usually reserved for Eagles games and baptisms.
Or when Santa Claus is on the field being pelted with batteries.
This match is obviously fucking bonkers. Public Enemy cuts down one side of the ring, the barbed wire roping, and they like wrap Terry's head in it. He looks like a like Kmart Hellraiser. And that shit gets like stuck in Terry. They eventually put a trash can on top of him and hit him with a chair and then pin him. But goddamn, this match is insane.
Well, there was a moment where Terry's wrapped in the barbed wire and he's got like the crushed trash can. He's just like running at people with it, trying to bump into him.
I think it'd be funny if I just kind of run into people. It'd be even funnier if my pants were down and my just wangers flapping around, running around, not seeing anything. I think it'd be even funnier. Hey, Rocco, pull my pants down. Let's see them wangers.
At some point, Dory loses a boot, too. He's in the ring with it, out of the ring, comes back. He's holding it for a second. He's like, fuck it, don't need this.
August 14th, Hardcore Heaven, Public Enemy, once again successfully defended their belts against the Bad Breed. But that's not the highlight of this show. Later that night, they got in one of the most momentous events in ECW history. In the main event that night, Cactus Jack faced Terry Funk in what was already a pretty hardcore match when Public Enemy came out to interfere as part of their beef with Terry. They try to give Jack a win, but he doesn't want a cheap victory, so they attack him too, eventually laying him on Funk and do like a self three count. And this kind of leads to a Jack and Terry versus Public Enemy scuffle. Terry manages to acquire some frying pans, and Shades of Emeril Lagasse bams them over Public Enemy to get the upper hand. He hits him with a pile driver, and then they make Public Enemy cover each other. Then Terry asked a fan to toss him a steel chair, but since he didn't specify which fan, they fucking all decided to do it. Rocco and Johnny get swarmed by a bee's nest of chairs as fans from the first several rows hurl their seats into the ring, leaving Public Enemy underneath a pile of about 50-ish chairs.
And, God, everybody wants to recreate this, but you don't know how fucking dangerous it
yeah,
is.
Yeah, please don't. Jesus Christ.
Fucking, there's so many people, like, recently I saw Lucky Ali being involved in something like this at, like, a Deadlock Pro show. And I immediately texted him afterwards. I was like, dude, if you're ever in like an incident where fans are throwing chairs in, whether you're instigating that or not, take one chair and cover your head and then flip over on your stomach to protect your fucking junk. But he was like in the middle of the ring and fans were throwing chairs in. And he was kind of like, as the chairs was falling on him, he was like taking the chairs and like selling them as they're hitting him. But it's like, you can't do that because you don't know where it's coming and it may be coming straight. And then they're going to like crack a rib, could take an eye out. And once they start coming and in the air, you don't have enough time to protect yourself. So what you want to do immediately is protect yourself right away and then let the rain come whenever it comes, if it comes at all. But everybody tries to recreate this and it's dangerous.
And you can't recreate this. This was so organic the way it happened, and anything after it's not going to be as cool, although it would be super awesome for this to happen with tents during one of your matches.
By the way, side note, did you see that there is a sports Instagram that took the tent video, put it on their account, and it has got 10 times more views than any of the other videos that they have on there?
It's been stolen like 50 times. I can't even keep
track. It's stolen, and it's the most successful thing they have on there, and it's actually like got 500,000 followers. So, like, it's the most successful thing they have.
August 27th, 94, in what seems to be the last event ever as Eastern Championship Wrestling, it would also be the last day of Public Enemy's first title run when Cactus and Mikey Whipwreck beat the crew for the tag belts. I think Mikey still follows us on Twitter, even though I don't use Twitter anymore. With a rebrand, ECW is now officially labeled Extreme. How they managed to avoid the 90s spelling of Extreme with an X is beyond me. But from here, Public Enemy would start trying to chase down Cactus and Mikey to get their belts back, and they do exactly that when they beat them at November to Remember to start their second title run.
Mikey was so over at this time in the arena. Like, what a great run. And Mikey will even tell you, like, he was like, man, I just was at the right place at the right fucking time, and here I am with Cactus Jack, Terry Funk, and just some of the best wrestlers in the world. All his idols, and he's getting to work them.
Finishing out year one of ECW, Public Enemy shut out Ron Simmons, Too Cold Scorpio, Hack Myers with JT Smith, and rematches from Whipwreck and Foley. Heading into the year of Montel Jordan and Toy Story 1, 1995. It was kind of more the same until they ran into the buzzsaw of Sabu and Taz at 95's Double Tables, losing the belts. This freed the boys up to do a little dip back over in Japan, wrestling for Wing. Throughout March, they did a few scramble bunkhouse death matches, mostly working with the Pitbulls. Back in ECW, they snatched their pants holders back, winning a three-way dance at ECW Three-Way Dance against Taz, Rick Steiner, who was subbing in for Sabu, Dean Malenko, and Redacted, at least the rest of this season. Right after that win, they got attacked by the Pit Bulls to kick off an American feud that involved false count anywhere matches, dog collar matches, and baseball bat matches.
If you have a tag team called the Pit Bulls, what gimmick match you think you're going to do? Dog collar matches.
They'd eventually lose the belts on Hardcore TV 115 to Raven and Stevie Richards when the Gangsters interfered, kicking off a full-scale feud with them. And this was New Jack and Mustafa's debut into ECW, coming straight for the Kings.
Well, and coming straight from Smoky Mountain Wrestling, they've got a lot of heat behind them at this time, and now they're in a completely different area. And then also to just the whole aspect of like, oh, you guys think you're gangsters? Well, guess fucking what? We're the real gangsters of this. And New Jack and Mustafa just worked so well with the Public Enemy. Like, there was just this sense of the gangsters were, I believe they'd be kind of more the heels in the instance of this, where like Public Enemy felt like, oh, these are Smoky Mountain guys coming in and taking on our guys. And I feel like this was like kind of the thing that kind of kicked it up another notch, like the popularity, to the point that like a lot of people's eyebrows were started to get raised a little bit, like, oh, this group Public Enemy, they're really popular, there might be something going on here.
I say this every time New Jack comes up, that man scares the fuck out of me. Do you remember the first time you had a match with somebody where how crazy the motherfucker was took you off guard?
I mean, Tracy Smothers was a crazy motherfucker, but like he was always the nicest person ever. Mm-hmm. But he'd catch you with something out of nowhere, like on accident, and he'd always be, oh, I'm sorry about that. Or, sorry about that. Through his teeth, because he would always talk that way. It kind of like, oh, I just got hit by a fucking man. But crazy, that was off-putting. Oh.
Someone like, I'm assuming the feeling you'd have if you ever stood across the ring from New Jack.
There was guys that I felt like that weren't going to do business and weren't going to hurt me. I mean, Necro Butcher was one of them, but he was fine. He was cool then, maybe not so much now. I mean, there was a little bit of a concern because Brutus the Barber Beefcake wasn't drunk enough to wrestle me one time, and he almost like choked me out with the sleeper hold, where the night before he could get as many Jack and Cokes as he wanted before he got to the ring. It was like easy. There's people like that.
Public Enemy took the bad side of the rivalry here. The Gangsters beat them at Heatwave 95 in a steel cage match and a stretcher match at WrestlePalooza, but they'd bounce back on a Hardcore TV 131 October 95 when Public Enemy beat Stevie and Raven and the Gangsters in a three-way to win their fourth and final ECW tag team title. Their reign ended really weird, not too much longer after they won. So they did like Too Cold Scorpio and Just Rocco in a match where Scorpio's TV title was up against the Public Enemy's tag title. And then, you know, Too Cold won. I believe this aired on Hardcore 133.
I think it was just like an effort to get like Too Cold over and like, yeah, I got the tag belts and he's got all the belts. And yeah, it seemed like something they were just kind of sacrificing. And also too, like, I don't know if Public Enemy really needed the belts. They'd won them four times now. They're the most overact. Whether they have them or don't, it's pretty inconsequential. So, you know, kick them over to Scorpio and see if it helps get them over.
Then November 19th, 95, the boys had a tryout wrestling a dark match at 95 Survivor Series, doing the job for the WWF tag champ Smoking Guns. They'd be back for December to Dismember, teaming with the Pitbulls and Tommy Dreamer to beat Raven, Stevie Richards, the Eliminators, Heavenly Bodies, and an Ultimate Jeopardy steel cage match. But that brings us to 96 and the end of Public Enemy's run in ECW. Just mentioned the WWF tryout match, but swerve, bro, they signed with WCW. At ECW's house party, 96, they beat the Gangsters one last time. Before the match, they got onto the mic and said that this was the House Public Enemy bill. You can take us out of ECW. Can't take ECW out of us. New Jack had some strong words for Harlem Heat. Then they have a batshit crazy brawl. Beaten, bloody. They cut another promo. Thank the ECW fans. And they're gone.
What? That's the sound of a rattlesnake in your earbuds. That's right, if you didn't want the stone cold Steve Austin experience, you need to shut them earbuds off right now. As a matter of fact, why don't you just take them ears and rip them off? Because if you don't want stone cold talking to you, then you don't deserve ears. Can I get a hell yeah? I'm gonna go ahead and assume you said it. I'm here today because I want to tell you about my friends over at Tin Bell Pod. Tin Bell Pod. Tyler Wood, Nick Alexander, and Jake, the Man Scout Man, and bringing you some of the best wrestling content on the internet. Now, can I get a hell yeah? while you're giving me a hell yeah, why don't you go ahead and pop over to their Patreon. Go ahead and give a subscription. And why don't you hop your fat little ass right over to Pro Wrestling Tees and get a Tin Bell Pod exclusive t-shirt featuring all three of these beautiful men. Might be saying, what? What? Stone Cold, you think these men are beautiful? God damn it, I do. Now you get over there and you buy that t-shirt before I stomp a mud hole in you and walk it dry. Now let me get a hell yeah.
And this is pretty commonplace. Like, you're a few months removed from Dean and Eddie kind of saying their goodbyes. There was a lot of top talent that was kind of there and then gone. But as the story goes, I think it was Terry Taylor, but somebody in WCW basically got a tape of ECW and saw everybody doing the with the hand wave thing. And they were like, you know what? That would be really cool in an arena. A bunch of people just going, Problem is, you have to buy the copyrights to that particular song if you want it to be that cool. You can't just do a watered-down, copyright-free version of it.
Kip my hot stepper,
murderer.
Kip my hot stepper,
murderer.
Kip my hot stepper,
murderer.
Kip my hot stepper,
tit, murderer.
Nah, 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 nah.
And expect the crowd to get behind something that's not as cool. Where if AEW was around in 1996, for fucking sure, Tony Khan would have bought the rights to Hot Stepper. That is 1,000% what would have happened. And you know what? Public Enemy might have been super fucking over, like, right away just because of that song.
So the hottest thing in ECW in Philly is now down in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and Augusta, Georgia, performing for fans of wrestling. Bit of an awkward transition for them. They have two key things Public Enemy has to overcome here. Before the NWO and flipping the channel back and forth during the Monday Night Wars, there was like a pretty hard divide in the people that watched WCW and WWF, with ECW for sure being the third wheel. And a big chunk of WCW fans had no fucking clue who they were. Issue number two, WCW, they had to do a bit more wrestling. Not that they couldn't. They could, especially Rocco. WCW tried to put them in like street fights and like accommodate them. But, you know, they had just spent the last year and a half smashing people with trash can lids. And now they have to do drop toe holds and chin locks. So they have to at least retool what they had been doing. And that takes time to get back into the flow of things.
Well, and also, too, like, you're not doing the things that got you over. The things that got you over were these big crazy brawls and hardcore stuff. Like, also, you got to reintroduce yourself. Everybody knew everything about you and saw everything cool you did. So when you walk to the ring, you walk to the ring with that reputation of everything cool you did. Where, much like me, I'm like, who are these guys? Okay, cool. Like, they're the rap guys. And they come out and they're doing the hand-waving thing and they come out with a table. Cool, all right. You know, I got to see that for about a year or two and put some belts on them. And, like, I liked them. When they came out, like, it worked for me, but it wasn't instantaneous. Yeah. So, yeah, like, I liked them.
They debuted January 15th, 96 on Nitro, getting a roll-up win over
the American males
before they stuff buff through two tables. Public Enemy's first proper WCW feud would be with the Nasty Boys. And that seems like that's a good matchup, like, style-wise,
yeah,
right?
That's a good fit.
Yeah, because it's like the 80s version and the 90s version of kind of the same tag team to an extent, if you really think about it.
At Clash 32, they wrestled to a double DQ, so then they met at Super Brawl 6 in a street fight. This is about 7 minutes of four men hitting each other with trash can lids. Public Enemy lose when Rocco tries to do his front flip off of a merch stand, and he misses and gets covered by Knobs. So I remember them. This was my introduction to Public Enemy. I didn't know the ECW shit when I was, you know, a kid watching around this time. I thought they were pretty cool. But comparing it to ECW, like, much later, I don't know if it's the setup or just the way WCW shot things, or it's most likely this, they can't do the ECW shit, but, like, there was just something, like, off about them in WCW.
It was polished. You know, shiny. They got more colors in their outfit, mm-hmm. and, like, everything's matching and made by somebody that's like, yeah, we need bright colors. It's not black and whatever else, or something you've wore several times over. Like, no, we got different matching. We got PE with a big yellow, like, pow sign explosion thing. And then your yellow and gray and red, as opposed to black and maybe blue and maybe a white every once in a while. So, yeah, it's mainstream. You know, like it's much more polished. That's just how it is. It's not happening in an intimate environment. And that's what I liked about Public Enemy. And I think that's what made Public Enemy so special, especially when they were doing stuff that was so violent. Like, you felt close to the violence, and the way that they also shot ECW, like very in your face, and the camera was very close and you were like right in there. Like, it felt violent, where, you know, when you got people out there waving Hulk Hogan foam fingers around, it doesn't really feel violent or dangerous.
Who do you guys think had the worst transition going from ECW to a bigger company where they just didn't fit?
Oh, Sandman, hands down, without question. Mikey was okay, but I mean, obviously wearing the dragon shirt with like the same outfit he had before, like, was a little like, who's this guy? Mm-hmm. Raven, I think, had the best.
Yeah, it was damn good.
But of course, Raven was just playing the hits. He was just recycling everything he did in ECW and doing it in WCW, which is smart. But yeah, it's definitely Sandman just never fucking translated there.
On Valentine's Day 96, they got their first shot at the WCW titles, losing to Lex Luger and Sting on a Saturday night taping. They lost again to the Nasties on TV and at house shows. They dropped TV matches to the Blue Bloods, Steiners, and even took a revenge loss to the American Males on Nitro. So no push to the moon out of the gate. Whoever brought that tape in of them having every member of the crowd waving their hands, that shit wasn't happening here. And they kind of get booked into the ground. They spent the next couple of months not really getting any meaningful TV wins as they headed to the last day wrestling was like it was, 96, Bash at the Beach. There, they took yet another loss to the Nasty Boys in a dog collar match. And again, after that, like, no meaningful feuds. And then, September 23rd, 96, on Nitro, out of nowhere, for no reason, like kayfabe-wise, they beat one of the greatest tag teams ever, Harlem Heat, for the tag team titles. It's not like squeaky clean. It's one of those double cradle spots where, like, whose shoulder's down? And they give the win to Rocco.
They did that a lot because they had so many great tag teams in WCW. Like, let's put the belt on them, and that will get them over, and that will establish them. And Harlem Heat benefited from that more so than anybody. So them doing a job to get these guys over definitely wasn't going to hurt them at all. Because that's what always happened. Like, there'd be this long out, drawn out feud. Harlem Heat would get the belt, you know, and they'd get a run with it. And then the Nasty Boys would take it out of nowhere. And then all of a sudden, Harlem Heat gets it back. And then all of a sudden, Bunkhouse Buck and Dirty Dick Slater do something dirty. And then, oh my gosh, they go after them. And then the Blue Bloods are involved. And then all of a sudden, the Blue Bloods win in a four-way. And there'd always be something. And then always Harlem Heat would come back. Losses for Harlem Heat in the tag division never hurt them because they just kept winning. And then when they became multiple-time tag team title holders, it kind of was, they got over because of that. Because they held it so many times. But yeah, you just would drop it somebody to give them validity. I mean, they did it with American Males. They did it with Dirty Dick Slater and Bunkhouse Buck. Just drop the belts to them and give them credibility right away.
Public Enemy snuck in a couple of successful title defenses against High Voltage and El Tecnico and Juventud Guerrera, who I don't like because X-Pac doesn't like him. But then after like just over a week on the top of the mountain, they dropped the belts right back off to Harlem Heat October 1st, 96 on a WCW Saturday night. October 10th, Rocco went down to IWA Mid-South to beat Bull Payne. So kind of neat that, you know, the whole Ted Petty Invitational, he was there.
As Ian will tell you, the part of the reason he did it was he heard that Ian was starting his own promotion. So Rocco's like, can I go work? Because probably like WCW is very like not like ECW and not like the indies. It's like TV and you got to hit your marks and all that. I mean, it's still 90s TV wrestling, which was still a bit loosey-goosey as opposed to now, but still was not probably the wrestling he enjoyed. And, you know, Ian was his friend, heard he had a show, and said, hey, if I show up, will that help you at all? And Ian's like, yeah, I would love a WCW wrestler to show up and wrestle on my show so I can get people packed in this old Kmart building to buy tickets every week here, please. And, you know, Rocco shows up. I think he did some crazy dive or something like that. I remember the explanation on the tape was like, Rocco Rock forgot that he had a WCW contract and went buck wild in this match or something like that. I think that was like the review on that match. But Rocco, that just stand-up guy. He heard his friend Ian had a promotion and wanted to help out.
By now, we've had 96 Bash at the Beach. We're heading towards 97. So we're balls Mahoney deep in the NWO, and if you're not wearing black and white, you're just not eating out there. They're not going to sniff the tag belts. Hall and Nash hold on to them a lot, and when they don't have the belts, Harlem Heat and the Steiners have tenure and WCW fan recognition over them. Public Enemy would like not be on Nitro every single week. They're mixing in more Saturday night tapings and mostly just collecting that Ted Turner money. Yee doggy. That said, 97 is like a better year as far as like win losses. At Super Brawl 7, they beat the Faces of Fear and Harlem Heat in a triangle match. The following night, they beat Mongo and Double J, Jake, on Nitro. They did take a loss to Harlem Heat at 97 Uncensored, but they around this time, they were like the kings of WCW Saturday Night, and that's where I mostly remember them from.
Yeah, and that WCW Saturday Night set was definitely not the intimate ECW arena. It was... It was the absolute opposite, and the ECW arena hat was a big part in getting over Public Enemy, and the location in which they filmed WCW Saturday Night was very much the reason why Public Enemy was stale, because it was a very neutered environment.
They mostly bounced around getting a mix of wins and losses with the usual tag team suspects, High Voltage, Harlem Heat, Steiners. Public Enemy wrapped up their 97 campaign with a title shot loss to the Steiners December 16th on a Saturday night taping. So another year with Turner, another year of like nothing too like amazing. 98 started with a good bit of wins, including a victory in a Philly Street Fight March 2nd against Ming and Hugh Morris. Tyler, say his name real quick.
Bill DeMott.
God damn it. April 13th, Nitro, Rocco lost to greatest wrestler in world, Goldberg. But again, in 98, there's like no through line. There's no big feuds for the most part. They're not like dying up there. They just haven't had any sort of success even close to ECW.
Well, and also too, the whole storyline for these couple of years is NWO versus WCW, yeah. And Public Enemy aren't WCW guys. They're ECW guys in WCW, yeah. So they're the odd men out. Like, they got there too late to be WCW guys, and there were WCW guys that got left out.
Towards the end of summer 98, they caught a bit of a storyline with the Dancing Fools, Alex Wright and Disco Inferno, who, according to my research, are Daniel Garcia's dads. Took their feud into 98's Road Wild for a street fight. There is a kitchen sink in this match, mailbox, toilet seat, ladders, tables. They put Disco through three tables when Rocco elbow drops him off like the lighting rig that was always surrounding the ring for these Sturgis shows. They get him into the ring, get a pin, and this would be Public Enemy's WCW swan song. They wrapped up in August. They were out of there by September.
What a way to go.
For the rest of 98 and into 99, they worked Ohio, doing a run with the Bushwhackers for Championship Wrestling. Great name. January 16th, 99's ECW House Party, they popped back up. There was a segment with the Dudleys and Joel Gartner mocking Public Enemy dressing like them. So Public Enemy confronts them, gets triple teamed, but out comes New Jack to save them. They did a little interaction with the crowd. They said the last 3 years had been a roller coaster ride, but if you open up our chest and look at our hearts, there's one thing stamped there, and that's ECW.
Good fucking promo.
I don't know if they were considering like a full-time ECW comeback, but you just wish they would have. They were going to have a match with the Dudleys at 99's Crossing the Line, but they had to cancel to go wrestle for WWF.
Do you know anything about the heat between the Dudleys and Public Enemy?
I've always heard it, but I've never gotten a full answer because Bubba Ray was talking, and I was like, this has got to be a lie. But I do know that there was some. So, and unfortunately, Ted Petty is not alive to tell his side of the story, and I don't care to listen to Bubba's side of the story. So what have you heard, Tyler?
It was on a Robert Feinstein shoot interview. Basically, it was, I think, during that run-in where they kept trying to get up to do the promo after a beatdown by the Dudleys, and they keep getting up, and, bro, you never get up from a 3D, bro. It's never, I don't know why I'm doing Vince Russo. I can't do Bubba Ray's fucking dumb accent. But you never get up from the 3D, you know? That's the most protected move. Can't get up from the 3D.
Oh, yeah.
And they got up, and they were, and he's like, it wasn't fucking selling. So we bent down there. We beat his ass again. We get to the back. He gets up again, starts talking. Go down there. The beatdown was even worse. And then he references what happens with the APA a little bit later. Even with all that and Bubba Ray being the way that he is, he did say when they went back to do the beatdown, he's like, I got too much respect for Ted Petty, so I didn't do anything to him.
So it's all Johnny. There we go.
The guy signed with WWF for a cup of coffee, and that coffee was from a pot that was left out at a gas station all day, kind of like scorched on the bottom, a little bit gross, but you drink it anyways because you're like, I'm in WWF, I need some coffee. So we all know Ted Petty, but Vince Petty too. Public Enemy came in with backstage heat because back in 95, they chose WCW over WWF. At Tuit, from the boys' standpoint, Public Enemy was brought in by Terry Taylor, and that did them no favors because Terry was a stooge and known bitch.
No allegedly to it, just straight up. And I think we're okay with that. He was most certainly a stooge for Dave Meltzer. That's why his matches always get the best reviews.
He was
always giving information to Dave Meltzer in exchange for positive reviews for his matches. Look it up. There is proof of that. And God, you're right how fucking petty WWE is. Because you didn't pick us first and you went to WCW, we'll fucking take it out on you and punish you, even though Bruce Prichard will get on a podcast. I'm like, that wasn't it at all. We had to do this and we had to do all this repackaging with them and get them introduced to our audiences, which are different and much more of a Northeast based area. And it'd be wrestling in mostly a Southern promotion, and nobody in the Northeast was even knew who they were. So we had to do a lot of introducing them to a national television audience. So whatever bullshit it is for the petty thing that Vince wanted.
Bruce gets worse when it comes to the APA shit.
Oh, jeez. I can't take his... I can't.
No, I like the podcast. And I always did. But when he went back to work with WWE, I feel like once he started collecting a paycheck from them again, yeah. I feel like that's where it started to turn and it started to be a little bit more noticeable because he has to see these people on a daily basis, which I respect. I know what Bruce is. Like, he is a company man. I work for this company. Why should I ever shit on the company I work for? Even though we're talking about stuff that happened in the past, I still want to talk positively about that. I appreciate somebody who's like, hey, these people give me a paycheck. How about I don't fucking shit on them? But then there's a point where you become a shill, you justify shitty behavior, and then you're not being truthful. And I think that there's that line was definitely being teetered on before I boycotted all Conrad Thompson podcasts, which I really wish I could lift because I really want to listen to Jeff Jarrett's podcast.
JR's is good. He quit giving a fuck about 4 years ago.
Oh, I know. I like JR too.
Another issue Public Enemy is running into here is they are walking into a lineup of really fucking good and really, really over tag teams. Like Hardy's, Edge and Christian are about to change the game. Two Cools simmering, about to pop off. LOD is there. The New Age Outlaws, X-Pac and Kane, I think, are getting ready to form up. So they're not like going to put the rocket ship on them just for showing up. On top of all those issues, Public Enemy was also a little lax with the WWF rules. Sure, they have 9 guys in the locker room snorting a crushed up Xanax, but this is WWF in a corporate structure. And Public Enemy tended to not be very punctual. Sure, we're a couple of months away from Vince killing Owen by dangling him 70 feet in the air by a paperclip, but he was there at 8:25, and that's what 8:30 really means. Public Enemy made their Raw debut February 16th against The Brood, Edge, and Gangrel, which aired the 22nd. It was taped the 16th. So Public Enemy is handling business, looking pretty good. Then Christian runs in to give them like the cheaper DQ win. The whole brood lights thing happens, and then lights turn back on. Public Enemy's covered in the brood bloodbath. On the March 1st, 99 Raw, Public Enemy shows up to cut a promo in brood costumes. Mid-promo, lights turn off again. They come back, Rocco's missing. Later, Grunge finds him hanging in the back by his arms, again covered in blood. They get beat by the Hardys on Sunday night's Heat 228. That takes us to March 2nd, 99's Heat, when they face Farouk and Bradshaw, the Alkalites. Alright, so the story behind this match. Public Enemy has all this heat. They're often late. Right before this match, literally as their music is playing, Public Enemy told Ron and JBL that they didn't want to do the finish, which was Public Enemy going through a table, but they didn't offer like a change. They just were like, not doing it, bye. And as we know, WWE is not a call it in the ring brother place. It's very curated, arguably overproduced. And the finish comes down from the office. So the Alkalites were like, yeah, we're bigger than them, so we're going to put them through the table anyways. So in the name of corporate synergy and professionalism, they go out there and proceed to slug away at Public Enemy for real in an infamously stiff, possibly all the way shoot match.
Jake, what would you do in a situation like that? Right before you go through the curtain, the person you're wrestling says, hey, the finish that we got from the booker, I'm not doing that. See ya.
I would do the match as we all laid out before then. Get to the point where they don't want to do it, and then just walk away. You didn't want to do it, so we didn't do it, so fuck you. I feel like that's what I would do. I think a younger version of me would want to get into some sort of tussle or fight or prove my manhood. I think now, as an older man, a wiser man, I think I would go out there, prove that the match that I had promised to lay out with this individual, and then when they said they don't want to do the finish, I'd ask right before we get to them, like, still not doing the finish? And they say, nope, not doing it, and they call the finish. I'm like, nope, not going to do that one either. Bye, and leave. Because I'm probably wrestling in front of 80 people, so who gives a fuck? I've probably already gotten my pay handed to me, so fuck it. I got that. Fuck you, deuces. This guy's an asshole. Bye.
You're not afraid of that making you look bad?
No. I've wrestled a fucking tent. How, like, what fucking do I have to protect? Also, too, I have 20 years of good matches. Why not entertain myself and make this a better story by just fucking walking out?
I get it, because as a host, I've given a comic the light to finish, and they did like 10 more minutes, and I wanted to punch them. So on some level, I understand.
Bruce Pritchard firmly in the Acolytes corner on this. Head and shoulders. He goes on about a 7-minute explanation as to how the locker room will police itself. And it somehow ended with him saying, and there are too many goddamn participation trophies nowadays.
That's just beat for beat exactly what I expect out of him.
I could see. If I was Ron Simmons and I had the ability to beat the fuck out of anybody at any moment in time, I'd be like, oh no, you're doing this finish because fuck you. JBL just needed a reason to be an asshole, and
yeah,
you fucking gave him one, so here you go. And you know, I can kind of see Public Enemy like feeling like, man, they don't get us, and fuck this. You know, I feel like I think they knew if that's what they said, then they knew it was coming to them. So this was like just a whatever thing, and they whatever consequences were going to come, they knew were going to come.
Yeah, there's a good chance they were going to get some amount of shit beat out of them by JBL, the patrolman of the WWE showers.
This very likely could be bias because I like Ron Simmons and I don't like JBL.
No, man, I already know where you're headed. He was complacent in so much bad shit.
He definitely was, especially with JBL on his hip, but in this match, it looked like he was mostly working. I'm not a pro wrestler, I can't really tell. While on the flip side of that, JBL literally bent a chair over Rocco's head.
I'll give it to you. I don't think Ron committed assault. That was a wrestler having a disagreement with somebody while JBL is trying to kill someone.
He handles it the way that JBL does.
Yeah, so he handles every problem.
And at the same time, too, like, if you're Public Enemy and you know this guy's already looking for a reason, like, just get through the match and be like, all right, let's just go do it, whatever, yeah, and then talk shit about him later. So he was a fucking asshole. Because he's going to fucking stiff you regardless. Don't you want to be in the right when he stiffs you?
So back to your point, Nick, about Ron Simmons. If JBL is to be believed, when JBL heard that from Johnny Grunge, he goes, well, what are we going to do? And Ron Simmons was the one who said, we're going to bring the table to them, which is like a fucking badass line.
I've heard that, and that sounds like something Ron Simmons would say.
You
like,
fight for me now.
Yeah, pretty much. You fight for me now.
While they did just get walloped by APA, the Public Enemy took it like champs. They shook the guy's hands in the back, and you would think not complaining about getting assaulted at your work while you're giving someone your body would lead to some sort of fucked up WWF logic respect. But no. And here is where I really, really wish there was a Public Enemy shoot interview, because my theory on this is that Public Enemy would have been like, dude, we wrestled New Jack in ECW. We didn't even notice APA was shooting on us.
And like sometimes like I think like maybe they were like bored and they're like, you know what? Let's do something fucked up. Make the shit interesting, you know, because sometimes you do that, too. And they might have been just making a joke.
Oh, dude, what if it was just
a
joke?
And
yeah, oh my God.
I wouldn't put it past them. Like, they might have just been making a joke. At WWE, you're not allowed to make a joke like that. And they just took it to the umpth degree, which I think is another interesting theory as well, too, that maybe they just made a joke. Like, we're not going to do that finish. Like, ha ha ha. Well, clearly we are. Like I said, I don't know the vibe or the tenor or how dry the joke was. But I can see JBL, like, fucking losing his goddamn mind. And, like, Ron Simmons, like, well, I'll just fuck you up. And that's how this is going to go.
Following this, they lost to Double J and Owen on Raw. They did not win a number one contender battle royal. They lost a four-team shotgun Saturday. Their final match with the company would be March 30th, 99, losing to the Hardy Boys via DQ. That match aired on April 10th, 99, and shortly after, they were released mid-April-ish. So their entire WWE run was getting buried, assaulted, and released.
That's a Stone Cold Steve Austin t-shirt, right?
From there, it was off to the American Indies, which weren't great in 99, but they would pop back up. WCW for 99's Bash at the Beach, taking part in the Junkyard Hardcore Invitational hosted by Hack, a.k.a. Sandman. It was Hack, Fit Finley, Cyclope, Jerry Flynn, Public Enemy, Horse Hogan, Brian Knobbs, Humorous, La Parca, Regal, Silver King, David Taylor, and good old Mikey Whipwreck.
You want my thoughts on this as they happen? As it starts from the helicopter's point of view, pointed down, you can tell that nobody really fucking knows what's going on in this match. Because there are times where you can hide things, you can switch camera angles, but this thing's so out in the open. It's being shot from a helicopter, which is pretty cool, but that's about where the...
Yeah.
I won't say that's where the coolness stops, but it's pretty weird. You can see somebody holding like a piece of sheet metal over their head, walking towards someone, realizing that they were doing something with someone else, and then just kind of putting it down and walking over to someone else to get kicked. And then you hear Tony Schiavone say, as they look up, as a Ford Pinto is flipped over by someone's hand. And Tony Schiavone goes, is that's the Public Enemy? And Bobby the Brain Heenan says, it's an invitational. Anyone can compete. That's the opposite, Bobby. You've got stuff painted on the cars, which make no sense. You have Bad Boys with a Z, Bane, like the Batman villain, and then somebody painted Happy Birthday, Ellie.
That's nice.
We are 2 minutes and 15 seconds in before they mention that Finley's in the match. La Parca was beating the shit out of somebody with a tailpipe. Fuck Bill DeMott. It was just the thought I had. Horace Hogan almost slammed someone into a car. He's like holding him by the back of the head, stops, changes direction like an NPC, and then throws him onto the hood, which I guess was somebody saying, no, this is the fucking hood spot. And Bobby Heenan, after that spot, goes, Horace just threw some guy into that car, which is how I felt watching the match. And then there was a Jimmy Hart sighting as he's in a hard hat pointing at some stuff. Regal got in the back of a truck and I think was just grappling with somebody to stay the fuck out of the mess that was La Parca, Silver King, and all the ECW guys. You have to go over a goddamn chain link fence to win. Good line by Bobby the Brain Heenan here. I think, it was Rocco Rock. He goes, his IQ's on the back of his jersey. It was a 00. Silver King got a big cut on his side. These luchadors were not fucking around during this match at all. Dave Taylor's on, he's on the ground. Somebody takes a piece of metal, hits him with it. Then they walk out of frame. The two guys that hit him with something, somebody else comes in, they walk out of frame. Dave Taylor stands right up, takes the tire off, and walks away like nothing happened to him. Someone tried to, I don't remember who it was, tried to fucking murder Finley. They tried to put him in the trunk of a car before it got put into a crusher. And then the car exploded when it got crushed.
Of course.
My dad is a mechanic. He owns a junkyard. And I got to tell you, there are several explosions every day. So that is 100% factual. under North Carolina law, which is, this wasn't filmed there, but they are adhering to North Carolina law also. You do have to have two cars on fire at any one time in your junkyard. And they explained the fire, the car exploding, as the cauldron of flames that was next to the car spilled over onto it. Why the fuck is there a cauldron in a junkyard? Is there some redneck witch performing voodoo spells on vehicles? And Finley's your winner. There you go.
I think at its very core, it's a great idea. It's almost like a cinematic match in some ways. It, you know, film from the helicopter. There's the fire. Just the atmosphere is nuts. It's just, with all the chaos, there's like no through line. And with all the camera cuts, you have no idea who's fighting who or why. And the idea was,
there's
cool,
a huge ring of crushed cars. And the way to get out is not to climb over the cars. You can walk past the cars and go to the goddamn chain link fence and just jump over. There's only one spot that's chain link, too. Finley's like, there were two people, Rocco Rock and Finley. They were the only two that ever went anywhere in the direction of where they were supposed to escape from.
Oh, WCW. Well, following this, Public Enemy hung around the WCW tag division, losing to the West Texas Rednecks on August 9th on Nitro and the Insane Clown Posse the following week. Their last match with the company would be August 19th, losing a 2-on-1 handicap match to Sid. Just kayfabe-wise, their stock could not be lower. It was right back to the indie scene. As Public Enemy headed towards Y2K, they did XPW in December, and again in early 2000, so who knows what they caught there. They did IGW, Superstars of Wrestling, down in Australia, working a couple shows with the Road Warriors. They worked X Wrestling in Orlando as the South Philly Posse. Then in 2002, they found a new Philly promotion to work in, Propane Pro Wrestling. Not like Hank Hill Propane, but like Pain Good. I'm for
3PW. Pain. 3PW.
But sadly, it was the fall of 02, September 21st, when he was actually on the way to a 3PW show, that Rocco Rock, a.k.a. Ted Petty, suffered a heart attack, passed away on the Jersey Turnpike, way too young age of 49. Obviously, when a wrestler, especially around this time, passes away, everyone assumes drugs, OD, but his family really wanted to put out there that this was a heart defect that runs in the family. This wasn't an OD. So all of a sudden, Johnny Grunge is by himself. His partner, his best pal, someone who he had traveled through backwoods, indies, ECW, WCW, WWF, gone. And it's said that he, like, never got over this. And a lot of people think this actually, like, played a role in his own death later on. Grunge formed the new Public Enemy with his, quote, brother, Joey Grunge. I could not find shit about this. I found a picture of Joey in a Public Enemy jersey. So, like, it happened. Jake, do you know anything about Joey?
Yeah,
Grunge?
I do. I've met him before. I think I've been on shows with him before. He was based out of the Midwest. He seemed very Carney-esque, and I met him before I moved to the South, where I met all of the Carney of the Carney. Like, even before I had knew what Carney was, like, I had a sense that that was that. Yeah, I think they did do, like, the new Public Enemy thing, but, I mean, Rocco was the man. He was the driving force of Public Enemy, and Johnny wasn't the guy that was pushing it forward. Like I said, Johnny was the follower. He was the guy that, like, okay, yeah, I'll do that, and I'll make sure that it's good and done the way you want it. And Joey Grunge, I think, did something nice for Johnny, and then he was able to call himself Joey Grunge, and then he got bookings out of it. But then I think people realized what that was about and didn't get anywhere. So, yeah, not great. Not great.
Mike's last match on Cage Match anyways. June 19th, 04, beating big ol' piece of shit, Rockin' Rebel. Then February 16th, 2006, Mike was visiting a friend in Peachtree, Georgia, when all of a sudden he was unable to breathe. His friend called the paramedics. Johnny Grunge was rushed to the hospital. Sadly, he was pronounced dead on arrival in Atlanta, Georgia. It was revealed that Michael Durham had died because of a coronary artery blockage. He was only 39. Public Enemy is yet to be included in the Hall of Fame. I know their actual WWE run was not good, but WWE now owns ECW, and there's no getting around the fact that Public Enemy helped build ECW and helped make ECW known and remembered. So you putting them in?
Oh, hands down. They were the thing that made ECW cool. And I think they're just now getting into, like, you see the Dudleys, you see Rob Van Dam. Like, you're starting to see ECW guys kind of sneak in a little bit. They won't get the big pomp and circumstance that some of those other people did. They'll be like, kind of get the Brickhouse Brown treatment. Like, you're in the Hall of Fame. Like just a graphic. That's all they'll get. Like, I don't even know if those people, like, their loved ones got a Hall of Fame ring or some sort of plaque from WWE. I don't know if they just, all they get is a graphic and a name on a list somewhere. But at the same time, too, Public Enemy deserves to be on that list.
I can't speak on really who does or doesn't deserve to be in the Hall of Fame. I don't think they ever will be, just because Vince McMahon, if he was bitter about it, 3 years later, he's bitter about it 30 years later. If it can't help him make millions of dollars, I don't think he believes in burying a hatchet. And I don't know if he would ever sign off on them being in the Hall of Fame. And I don't know if whoever takes over the WWE after Vince would feel that they should go in.
I will disagree with you. I think Vince McMahon loves putting people in the Hall of Fame when they're dead so they can't enjoy it.
There we go.
I think that's the game he's playing and knowing that he's in the Hall of Fame.
That's more fucked up. That's better, yeah.
that's who I think Vince McMahon is.
All right, final thoughts on Public Enemy.
Public Enemy was definitely a cornerstone of ECW, and they had great feuds throughout with not the least of which I enjoyed the match I saw with New Jack and Mustafa. Just, it's like every other New Jack match, but it's fun every time.
Yeah,
it's fun to watch car wrecks. I like that. And these two guys, while they had solid wrestling backgrounds, they paved a way for ECW to go on become the flourishing super indie before super indies were a thing that it was. And I don't think they got a fair shake in either of the big companies because nobody knew what to do with them. They couldn't recreate the thing that happened on a small scale. And you see it all the time in wrestling. Somebody does a great character in one place, they switch companies and it just can't be replicated, or they're big on the indies and something just doesn't click when they go up to WWE now. And I'm wondering if maybe at some point a gimmick change might have helped or hurt them in the WCW, WWF time. But yeah, what could have been?
Yeah. If you are a hardcore wrestling fan, they have to be on your Rushmore for hardcore wrestling tag teams. They're very important for hardcore wrestling. I remember them popping up in WCW. Always thought they were pretty cool. Like, I can close my eyes and see them carrying down a table to the WCW Saturday night set. They wreak so much havoc in such a short amount of time. Like, you know, to this day, they're a standout tag team from the 90s, but they were on top for what, like 3-4 years? Kind of a what if in terms of how they did get booked in WCW and WWF. And digging a little deeper, a bigger what if the right person would have got a hold of Cheetah Kid. But you know, obviously helped push ECW to the next level. You can't tell the story of pro wrestling without ECW, and you absolutely cannot tell the story of ECW without Rocco Rock and Johnny Grunge.
If anything, they were the first major homegrown star. I mean, yeah, Dean and Eddie, they were probably the first to go, but as far as guys that, like, were there, they developed this character, this gimmick, and then all of a sudden they got put on a national stage, they were, like, the first one. So, like, guys like Raven, Tommy Dreamer, Rob Van Dam, Balls Mahoney. It's just a whole bunch of guys. Owe the whole career to Public Enemy. And the atmosphere that was created in that ECW arena was started by them. Like, they were the piece that made that crowd come alive, and people wanted to replicate that in a stadium, and they didn't know how. People tried, and it would have been interesting to see. Like I said, if Tony Khan was around, he would have bought the rights to the song that got them over, and does that make people go in arena, wave their hands around like they did in the ECW arena? I don't know. That's something to be said when people criticize Tony for buying licensed music and putting it on his television program. There's something to be said with popular music being used in professional wrestling and to get people over. Public Enemy was an example of that. But they deserve to be in the Hall of Fame. I feel like they're going to be in the Hall of Fame because of the really fucked up reason I just listed to you. But they definitely deserve it. As I said, I think there is a documentary in the works being developed by Michael Elliott, who, when he first started working in High Spots, had no fucking clue about ECW, but thankfully Mike Johnson has taken him by the hand and guided him through the history of ECW, and I think over time, like, he's become a very good student of the game, and I think Mike Johnson will be very much involved in this Public Enemy documentary that'll be coming out sometime, hopefully soon. It'll be nice to see that there'll be people that get to hear their story in a documentary form, so I look forward to that. It might be one of the few things that I actually purchase from High Spots. Or I'll just, you know, find it on YouTube illegally. Whatever. Do what you want. But Public Enemy is a very important team, and I'm glad we got to talk about them today, because that's what this podcast is about, is talking about the people who are forgotten that really kind of paved the way for a lot of fans loving professional wrestling.
All right. That is the great Public Enemy's Tim Bell Pod. Thanks for listening. I feel like I say the same thing every time. Thank you for donating to Patreon. Check out our pro wrestling t-shirt. Say hello on the social medias. Jake Tyler.
Make sure you leave a review on whatever platform you are using. It helps the show out greatly because algorithms are real. Don't I know it? I have cracked the code on algorithms for eBay selling. And the algorithm is also real for podcasting, so make sure you leave a review, because that helps crack that code.
Guys, go ahead and give us some suggestions on what you'd like to see for Patreon exclusive episodes. Maybe put some knowledge to the test, maybe a battle of quick wits, or drunk pro wrestling history. Whatever you guys want to see, let us know, and we will do our best to bring it to you. And Nick, why don't you send them off this week?
And that's the way the cookie crumbles.
Great job, Nick. Bye, everybody. Na 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 na